recordings of wolf howls and distant choral crickets. Slides illuminate the screen, complementing and counterpointing the text and the music. For all its catchy humor, the end effect is disturbing and strangely moving. Such are the concert appearances of Laurie Anderson, who is without question the hottest new vanguard pop performer in America, even if pop should maybe be put in quotes. Well, that's all a quote from John Rockwell of the New York Times. Laurie Anderson grew up in Chicago, moved to New York to study art history at Barnard College in 1970. Violin, the instrument she studied as a child, became the instrument she used in her performances. She's been doing performance pieces since the early 70s, and until recently her work was mostly known within art and avant-garde circles. In 1980, she began using a vocoder, a voice-activated synthesizer. She used it for her record, O Superman. It became a hit in England, reached number 2 on the charts. She now has a contract with Warner Records, which released her album Big Science, which featured music from her piece United States. The Institute of Contemporary Art is about to open a retrospective of Laurie Anderson's work, featuring records, photographs, scores, and documentation of her performances. The show opens tonight and continues through December 14th. In honor of the ICA's 20th anniversary, Anderson will present 2 lecture demonstrations on Friday, November 18th. The 4:30 presentation will focus on her visual work, the 7:30 presentation on her music. For ticket information, you can call 898-6791. It's 898-6791. And the performance will be at the Annenberg Center at 3680 Walnut Street. The Institute of Contemporary Art is on the University of Pennsylvania campus on the corner of 34th and Walnut Streets. A little later on, we'll be hearing some work from a soon-to-be-released Laurie Anderson record. But before we talk, I just want to play one more thing from Laurie Anderson's album Big Science, and this is From the Air. Okay, we'll have that ready in just a moment. So in the meantime, Laurie, let me welcome you back to Fresh Air, and it's great to see you again. Congratulations on the show, which looks really terrific. I got a chance to see a little preview of that last night. Are we ready to go with be ready? Okay, before we talk, let's listen to the first selection from Big Science, From the Air.
Thank you. got eyes in the back of my head. Why? It's the heat.
Laurie Anderson from the album Big Science, and Laurie Anderson is my guest, and her show at the Institute of Contemporary Art opens tonight. And again, welcome to Fresh Air. Did you have a pretty conventional upbringing, Laurie?
I'm not sure what conventional is. Probably not. It was a pretty odd family, actually.
In what ways do you think it was odd?
Well, first it was very big and sort of very organized. I have seven brothers and sisters. And we did a lot of things together, actually, and had a lot of kind of rituals. We had things like backwards day, where you can wear your clothes backwards and eat breakfast at dinner time, things like that. We didn't think it was strange at the time, but I think that when we went to school walking backwards, wearing our clothes backwards, I remember other kids going, how come you're doing that? But it was, I had a wonderful time when I was growing up, mostly because I was sort of responsible for the younger ones in a way. And I liked that a lot. I liked being able to show them how to do things.
Was there a lot of art or music in the house?
Yeah, there was. Everybody played an instrument and more or less, you know, and we did a lot of plays and my sister and I in particular did a lot of plays. Some, the ones I remember best were on roller skates with records that we would sort of cue up and roller skate these dramas, too.
that you'd make up?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This was in Chicago that you grew up?
Mm-hmm.
And you went to New York in about 1970 to
No, actually, I was there I began school, Barnard College, in 67, and graduate school in 70, I think.
Well, how did it change your life when you got to New York?
Well, I'd always wanted to go there. And I think the first time I realized there was a New York was, I guess in the 50s when I saw it on, I saw New York on TV before tape, and it was seemed so exciting because it was, I think the main thing was that they would say good evening, it's 9 o'clock in New York, and you look at the clock and it was 8 o'clock, always seemed so strange to me, and it always seemed much more exciting in New York, much always later and darker, and I always wanted to go there.
Did you become part of an art scene when you moved there?
Yeah, but very gradually. I've lived in a lot of different New Yorks. The first was an academic New York. And at Barnard, that you really weren't able to to concentrate on making things. You could only have a major in art history. I think they thought making things was just too messy. You have to get your hands all dirty. Much better to think about them and analyze them. So we... And I really value that a lot as a kind of introduction to the ideas behind the work. So I studied mostly American art history, but also Egyptian architecture was one of my specialties, and Assyrian sculpture.
What did you want to study art history instead of going to art school to learn more about art, making art?
At the time, I think that I considered the work that I was doing. I was doing a lot of painting and sculpture also, but I thought that was more private, that I didn't really want to be part of an institution that would tell me how to make it. I liked being part of an institution for what they could tell me about how other people had made art. But I did a lot of paintings while I was at school. But it just... but also, as I said, it wasn't possible to study that at the school that I went to.
When did you start doing performance art?
I think the first time I thought of doing that was... I was making a lot of really big photographs and what was called photo-narrative things. And they were really just stories with photographs attached to them. And I put them on walls and galleries. And at a certain point, it occurred to me that so much of the story was really missing because it was just written. It wasn't spoken. Because there's such a difference between reading something, of course, and hearing it, just the way when you get a letter from someone, they could say the exact same thing that they would in a phone call, but in the phone call you get not only the words but the tone of voice, and that's a lot more information. So I thought if I really want to work with words, I should work with all of their dimensions. And so I started doing things that were just spoken. Well, actually, not just, because they were also... At that point, slides in the work, and a very small bit of music, very tentative actually, because I had stopped playing the violin when I was 16, and only gradually began to use it in performances. After that, I think mostly because I had been. Sort of put off by the kind of professionalism that you had to have as a young musician. You really had to practice 8 hours a day, and that was really just about all you could do. Well, like any highly trained art form or sport or anything, you really have to do it a lot. And there were other things that I wanted to learn, so I just stopped.
Were you shy about performing when you started?
Yeah, I was. It was so odd because I hadn't really touched the violin in years. And I was also kind of afraid of it and afraid of all of those sort of ideas about virtuosity and things that I didn't want to do with it. Because I'd been playing it. I had thought that I think that it was a piano. I was playing it really percussively. And I hadn't realized that this was one of the saddest instruments that's ever been designed. And I hadn't, when I was a kid, hadn't played it that way. And also it's the closest to the human voice, human female voice.
You said you were afraid of that virtuosity, of the need for virtuosity. Part of the violin performance you did was really anti-virtuosity. Mm. You did one kind of thing where you attached... why don't you explain it, where you attach the audio tape to the bow instead of the horsehair?
Oh, yeah. Well, when I first began using the violin, I I didn't use it at all as an instrument. I used it as a ventriloquist dummy, just as another kind of voice to talk to. And so the first violin I designed had a speaker inside it, so it would play by itself. And that's over in the show at the ICA, hanging on the wall, not playing. And the second one was a turntable, battery-powered turntable mounted on the body of the violin, and the needle is in the bow so that the needle is lowered down onto the record. Your arm becomes kind of tone arm, and it's one of the worst-sounding instruments I think I've ever heard. It really sounds like seals or barking seals or something. And then the other one was called a tape bow violin, and that has a playback head, just the little part of your tape recorder that picks up the magnetic signal, was ripped off a perfectly good Revox and put attached to where the bridge would be on the violin. And then instead of horsehair on the bow, there's a strip of recorded audio tape. So you play the tape back and forth across the head, of course, making backwards as well as forward sounds, just like the bow motion.
We have a recording of one of the pieces you did with that kind of violin. Why don't we listen to a selection from it? This is from an anthology called Airwaves, and we'll hear two songs for tape bow violin, Ethics is the Aesthetics of the Future, and Song for Juanita. Do you want to say anything about it? It's from 1977, which is a while back for you.
I haven't heard of them for a while, so I'm kind of looking forward to it.
Okay, well, let's listen to them.
Ethics is the aesthetics. Ethics is the aesthetics of... Ethics is the aesthetics of the few.
The aesthetics of the few.
Aesthetics of... Ethics is the aesthetics of the few. Of the few. Of the few.
Sure.
Last summer, I spent a couple of weeks in a Buddhist monastery. We just heard Ethics is the Aesthetics of the Future, and it sounded like you were fast-forwarding it and re-cueing it on a tape machine, but what you were doing was...
That was the instrument playing. Recorded on the piece of tape is Ethics is the Aesthetics of the Future, and this is a quote of Lenin, and something that I was really interested in, a sort of idea that I was interested in particularly when I was teaching art history, which was also when I was beginning to do performances. And it was basically because one of the questions in the course that I was teaching was really, why do people bother to make art? What is really the point? And in looking for the answer to that, there I just found a lot of different kinds of answers. And one was Lenin's answer, which is, Ethics is the aesthetics of the future, meaning, of course, that in the future we'll all be good to each other, so we won't have to make these beautiful things. Another alternate reading of what he said would be really that in the past people had certain social, political, economic ideas, and in order to convince other people of their truth, they made beautiful objects and sort of put those ideas into them, whether they were, you know, ideas of about the church or religion or politics. And then at a certain point, the need to convince people of these ideas in that way fell away, and a number of people are left in the habit of making beautiful things. But to what end? And then, of course, aesthetics comes into the picture and says, You know, just we make beautiful things for their own sake. Look at this white cube. Look how white this cube is. And then someone comes in off the street into a museum and says, why am I looking at this white cube? I've got white cubes like that at home and I don't stare at them. You know, what really am I looking at here? And what happens then is a very funny situation of specialism or specialties, really, that there grows up around these objects a group of people who say, we know why it's important to look at this white cube. Maybe you out there don't, but we do. And it becomes, of course, a very elitist situation. And Lenin's quotation, ethics is the aesthetics of the future, I cut slightly short to point to that sort of other aspect of this. Ethics is the aesthetics of the few, Ethics is the aesthetics of the future. Just because also another thing that I was thinking about at that time was when things get that specialized, not only in art, but in any other kind of discipline, it's so easy to lose your perspective. And you pretty soon, if you have a certain kind of job, you find that the only people that you can really talk to are people who have that same kind of very specialized job. And that the other people in the world you can hardly talk to. You can't understand them and they can't understand you. And the whole, and also what we were saying about virtuosity, it's really kind of the same issue of people becoming so highly specialized that almost you really lose perspective, or I was losing perspective, let's put it that way. And so that was one of the reasons that I was that I wrote that song for Lenin.
Laurie Anderson is my guest, and if you'd like to see some of her work, some of her visual artwork, as well as scores of her music, and listen to a lot of tapes and records of it, there's a show that opens tonight at the Institute of Contemporary Art that's a retrospective of her visual work and music. And it's also the ICA's 20th anniversary, and she'll be doing two performances in honor of that on November 18th. And one's at 4:30 and one's at 7:30. And for more information, you can call the ICA, or for ticket information, you can call 898-6791. That's 898-6791. Now, you did one piece when you were doing your early performance art called Duets on Ice. Want to describe that for us?
Yeah, that was using one of the violins that we were mentioning before, which is a self-playing violin and has a speaker inside. And you can play duets with it live. And so this was a series of these duets that I did in Genoa, in Italy, and also in New York, on the street. And because they were loops, really, there was no logical stopping point. And so I decided that the timing mechanism for these would be a pair of ice skates. Get a cold thinking of this. It was really cold. A pair of ice skates frozen into two blocks of ice, and which I wore during the concert. And when the ice melted, the concert was over. And in between times talked about, well, really, the parallels between ice skating and violin playing, blades over a surface, really what it means to synchronize your feet, put one foot in front of the other when you skate or when you walk, and what it means to stay in sync with someone when you're playing a duet. It's that kind of rhythm that you get into. And there were a lot of theories that sort of grew up around the piece. Someone in Italy thought that the sawing on the violin was making the ice form around the skates or something like this. It was really there's some photographs of that work at the ICA also.
Yeah, and I want to remind our listeners that we'll be hearing a new recording by Laurie Anderson that will be officially released in December, but she has a tape with her that we'll be hearing an excerpt of in just a few minutes. You've been working with electronics, haven't given up violin either, I suppose.
No, actually, I've been doing more on the
violin.
Yeah, it's been real exciting to actually gradually learn how to play it again in a different way.
Your record, Oh Superman, which we heard a little earlier, was a real hit in England. It got to be number two on the charts there.
Mm-hmm.
What's it been like for you, first of all, when you started going to England to perform, which I imagine you did when it was on the charts? It was a kind of recognition that I'm sure you weren't used to before. Most of your audiences were within arts and performance art circles, which is a pretty small group of people. When you started getting that popular recognition, was it very different for you?
Well, it was a little more gradual than that. I think that the first time I realized that I could do things for people other than other artists or a very small art world was in, I guess, 78. I was doing something in Houston. And the museum there was built in the 60s for very large minimal sculpture. And gigantic, cavernous, big rooms. And then, of course, all the artists started working very small the next decade. And then, you know, these tiny objects are rattling around in these big reverberant places. At any rate, they're very bad places to do a performance because the sound is awful. It's just lots and lots of echo. So they said, you know, I said, well, why not do it somewhere else? And they said, well, yeah, but there's just, you know, country and western bars. I said, that'd be great. So we found this wonderful, huge, barn-like place with real nice acoustics. And for some reason, it was advertised by that place as a kind of country fiddling evening. And so a lot of the regulars from the bar came, and then a lot of the art people came. It was really an odd mixture. And I realized that the people, the regulars, who came to the barn, actually really liked it. They got it perfectly. You know, it was just someone who's telling stories. That's not strange. Playing the violin, that's not strange. Movies, that's a little strange. Some of the stories were a little bit odd, but they really did. I really felt that they understood what I was doing very, very well. And so I thought, maybe I'll just keep trying this. And so I always tried to, since then, do things in lots of different contexts. And a typical tour now includes a lot of really sort of strange mixture of places. Still some museums, some rock and roll clubs, some like Masonic lodges that have no history of anybody sort of coming to them in terms of concerts. So, and I do that because I suppose because I'm afraid of getting into a certain kind of on a certain kind of circuit, because then people's expectations and your own begin to conform to the place. If you think that you're doing a rock and roll concert, then, or you're going to do it in a rock and roll club, then I think there would be more tendency to sort of make adjustments for the sound system and maybe bring a drummer and all of that. So I try to mix it up.
You signed with Warner Records after first releasing Oh Superman independently. It was becoming so popular. They offered you a record contract, and you accepted it. Did you have to do a lot of soul-searching before deciding if you wanted to sign with a major record company that would perhaps have expectations of you or control over your music that you wouldn't want?
Well, first of all, I'd been talking to them before releasing the record, but I think that was the reason that they were interested in my work. Also, I think that particular company has a very interesting reputation for working with artists who aren't million sellers and things like that, and have a record of being very supportive of those artists. And I've really enjoyed working with them. It's been... but I think that it was different for me than for a lot of people who sign a record contract, because it was much later for me than excuse me, than for say an 18-year-old guitar player who a record company comes up and says, "We're going to make you a star and you're going to tour Europe," and you know, those kinds of things. You know, I'd been doing tours of Europe for years, and I knew that that was not glamorous. You know, that's so much work, and so I didn't have a lot of those kinds of expectations or illusions about what that would be, and also knew pretty much what I wanted to do. And the best thing is that they don't interfere with things. You can work at your own pace and give them a record. And they don't breathe down your neck or tell you that you should do this or that. And that I couldn't do it under any other circumstances. I'm too used to being autocratic about it.
Do you think that your work has been perceived differently since you signed with Warner's?
Yeah, I think so. It's not really surprising. One of the things that was sort of a surprise, but now sort of isn't, was really that some people in the art world really thought, "Oh no, what a sellout! This is just ridiculous. How could you do that? This is just like the lowest, you know, the pop world." And I was very hurt by that at first, and then I realized that it was exactly the same attitude that I had benefited by in the past, and that was a group of people who say, you know, we know what's going on, and as we were talking about before, but they don't out there, and we're very protective of our own because we're smarter, and we're, you know, et cetera, the whole story, and now that things are different for me, it's the same attitude of saying, well, that work is in a different place, so it can no longer be respectable. I on the other hand, think that it's not appropriate for all artists or art forms to be to use other sort of outlets like radio, TV, different kinds of performance spaces, but I think for some it works very well, and that the less stigma attached to that, I think the better. I hope that that more artists move out of or for those whose work would benefit by it. I hope that they feel that they can move in different ways through the culture, and that they don't have to always stay within the avant-garde, because that can really be I think it can be limiting terms, especially in terms of ideas, because you can get then again to be a kind of specialist.
Lori Anderson is my guest if you're just joining us, and a retrospective of her work opens tonight at the Institute of Contemporary Art on 34th and Walnut Streets. You have a new record that Warner will be releasing in December,
mm-hmm.
and I'm glad to say you've brought with you a tape mm-hmm. of, I guess, a test-pressing type mm-hmm. tape. Can we listen to a selection from it? And I'd like to ask you to introduce for us what we're going to hear.
Yeah, this is a song called Sharky's Day. And Sharky is a kind of, well, sorry, he'll speak for himself. He's kind of quite a character. The musicians on it are, there are a lot of people playing on it. I was listening to a lot of Cuban music and going to a lot of Cuban clubs this summer. And so I thought of this kind of as a country and western song, but more Cuban and western, maybe, sort of C&W. So there's a Cuban musician, Daniel Ponce, playing on it, and excuse me, and Anton Fear, who plays drums, and a group called November singing, and Adrian Ballou on guitar, and Bill Laswell on bass, and Who else? There's lots of and lots of little animals in it. And I think I'm leaving someone out. It's every instrument that I swore I'd never put on a record is in the song: guitar, bass, drums. It's all there. I just yesterday mixed another version of this song called Sharky's Night, and William Burroughs is doing the vocals for that. But this is Sharky's Day.
Let's hear it.
Sun's coming up like a big bald head bulging up over the grocery store. It's Sharky's day. It's Sharky's day today. Sharky wakes up and Sharky says, there was this man and there was this road, and if only I could remember these dreams. I know they're trying to tell me something. Sharky says, I turn around, it's fear. I turn around again, and it's love.
Oh yeah,
strange dreams. And a little girl sings. And the manager says, Mr. Sharky, he's not at his desk right now. Could I take a message? And the little girl sings. They sing.
Sharky, yeah, he's Mr. Heartbreak.
Sharky says, all of nature talks to me. If I could just figure out what it was trying to tell me. Listen. Trees are swinging in the breeze. They're talking to me. Insects are rubbing their legs together. They're all talking. They're talking to me and short animals. They're bucking up on their hind legs, talking. Talking to me. Hey, look out! Bugs are crawling on my legs. Yeah, I'd rather see this on TV. Tones of death. Sharky says,
I turn around. It's fear.
I turn around again. Sharky says, all night long I think of those little planes up there, flying around, you can't even see them, they're specks, and they're full of tiny people, going places, and Sharky says, you know, I bet they could all land on the head of a pin.
Sharky says, lights, camera, action, dinner.
opposite direction. You know, they're growing mechanical trees. They grow to their full height, and then they chop themselves down. All life comes from some strange lagoon. Rises up, it bucks up to its full height from a boggy swamp on a foggy night. It creeps into your house, its light's light. I've already paid for this. Listen to my heartbeat. The little girls sing. Sharky says,
I turn around, it's fear. I turn around again, and it's love.
Little girl sings.
Sharky's Day, written and performed by Laurie Anderson from her forthcoming album, scheduled to be released probably in December on Warner Records. That sounded great, Laurie.
Thanks. Real swamp mix.
You were telling me that's dedicated to Burt Reynolds?
Oh, no, that's a secret.
Oh.
That's okay. Not anymore.
Oops.
No, we did it also just yesterday finished a version called Sharky's Night, and that's the... vocals on that version are done by William Burroughs, and he one of my favorite voices in the whole world. Great voice.
Do you have any rock videos?
Do I have any? I'm going to be working on one for this, actually, for this song.
What do you think of them? What do you like and not like about the rock videos you've seen so far?
Well, it's. Of course, they're usually done very, very quickly, and that's a real, that's hard. It's hard to make a very good short film fast. So I think that that's a lot of people's problems. And also, there are people who sometimes aren't particularly visual who are suddenly forced into thinking visually. A band who finishes a record and the record company says, okay, on the audio, how about the video? And they go, well, wait, we don't know about it. And so it's hard. And it ends up with a lot of things like, you know, boys playing guitar in the showers, boys playing guitar in the street, boys playing the guitar on the rooftop. I mean, if you hear someone playing the guitar, you assume someone is playing it somewhere. So it's kind of redundant, unless the person is a really great performer and really fun to watch.
Yeah, you mentioned boys playing guitar here and there. And it is a real boys or men's world in rock, which is a world that you have at least one foot into now. Have you been meeting with a lot of sexism in the rock part of your work?
I guess that since I don't look for it, I don't really find it. And I think that there probably is, and the whole idea of the dumb girl singer. But I don't think that I've ever been a particularly, well, I can't sing. That's one of my problems, so I can't be a dumb girl singer.
I know you have to leave in a moment, but does your new album signify any changes in your direction musically?
Yeah, it does, because I got a chance to work with people that who are really, really great musicians, and it's more musical than it has been in the past, and it's also there's more singing in it rather than talking. There's still talking because I really do like the sound of jabbering, but it has a different kind of flow to it than the others, and they're also sort of more atmospheric now.
Well, I enjoy your work, and I want to thank you so much for coming back and visiting with us on Fresh
Air.
It's
great to be here. Thanks.
I'll look forward to going back and seeing your show at the ICA. Laurie Anderson has been my guest, performer, artist, writer. And there's a retrospective of her work at the Institute of Contemporary Art, which opens tonight. And this includes scores, records, tapes, some like special jukebox type exhibits and dream exhibits within there that are in rooms that you walk into. There are documentations of her performance works, and it's quite a biographical presentation. It's at the Institute of Contemporary Art, which is on 34th and Walnut Streets on the University of Pennsylvania campus. There's also a couple of performances scheduled for November 18th, one at 4:30, which will be focusing on her visual work, and one at 7:30, focusing on her music. For ticket information, you can call 898-6791. The performances will be at the Annenberg Center at 3680 Walnut Street. Her exhibit is at the Institute of Contemporary Art on the University of Pennsylvania campus on 34th and Walnut Streets. And Laurie, thanks again for being here.
Yeah, thanks. Bye.
I'll tell you what's happening Monday afternoon on Fresh Air and what's happening this Sunday at 2 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air after this report from Shadow Traffic.
Good afternoon, everyone. Traffic a little bit heavy southbound 95 in the area of Cottman Avenue due to an earlier accident involving an overturned truck that's upright and off to the side now. All lanes are open. Northbound 95 slows for a half a mile approaching the Ray Street merger, again from Aramingo through approaching Allegheny and on out through Bridge Street. At the Cottman off-ramp, you'll find some slow conditions. At the base of that ramp, at Cottman Avenue and State Road, an accident in the process of being cleared. Eastbound Schuylkill slow between Strawberry Mansion and South Minor, accident off to the side, a 20-minute delay there. Westbound slows from Bear through Vine and a three-quarter of a mile back up approaching 202. Northbound on the Boulevard approaching 5th Inner Drive, an accident in the process of being cleared. And a 7 o'clock opening expected for the Tacony-Palmyra Bridge. That's Shadow Traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is John Brown.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded with a grant from Blaupunkt Radio. Monday afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by Amy Lauren, who has written several romantic novels for the Candlelight Ecstasy Romance series. And as you know, romances are very popular now, and we'll be hearing about her approach to writing them Monday at 3 o'clock. And at 4 o'clock on the Marion McPartland Piano Jazz Series, her guest will be pianist Joe Bushkin, who will be with us, with her for some duets and conversation. This Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air, we'll feature an interview with film director, producer, and screenwriter Peter Bogdanovich. And we'll also hear from accordionist William Schimmel. And we'll hear an excerpt of the interview he recorded here over the summer in which he brought his accordion and performed several tangos and other songs. He was featured in the Joseph Papp production of the Three Penny Opera. He was the accordionist for that and also performed in David Del Tredici's Final Alice. He's the accordionist on the Tango Project album on Nonesuch Records. So that's all coming up Sunday at 2 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air. That about does it for today's show. John Knapp was the technical director. Maeve McGoran is the associate producer. Danny Miller, the co-producer of the show. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a terrific weekend. is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Cokie Roberts.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered. What you're about to hear is not really happening. This is only a simulated earthquake.
What's happening here? Well, the building is just keeping moving, and we don't know what's going to happen.
We have broken glass here.
A radio station in Los Angeles teaches its listeners what to do in a major earthquake, a fake quake, tonight on All Things Considered.
Also, these stories puzzle reactions to the naming of William Clark as Interior Secretary.
Some think it's part of a presidential strategy to play to the right.
John Glenn's strategy to beat Walter Mondale.
Schools in Texas criticized for too much football.
A school in Kansas promises a job or your money back.
And Hard Sell is here again.
First, we have this hour's news.
This is Brian Naylor. The American Marines in Beirut were again under fire today. In two separate incidents, snipers shot and killed one and severely wounded another. In the last 6 weeks of their peacekeeping duties, five Marines have been killed and 41 wounded. The BBC's Gerald Butt filed this report from Beirut.
The Marines were driving in jeeps inside the perimeter of Beirut Airport, close to their base, when snipers opened up. One Marine who was hit in the legs was taken by helicopter to a U.S. Navy ship offshore for treatment. A little later, a second man was hit in the chest. He, too, was taken to the ship, but was dead on arrival. These were the first casualties among the Marines since the current ceasefire came into effect 3 weeks ago. A Marine spokesman said the shots had come from a nearby slum district inhabited mainly by Shiite Muslims. He believed that certain groups there were harassing the Americans to try to draw them into a wider confrontation. As well as underlining the dangers that the Marines face, even when a ceasefire is in operation, the incident is yet another in a now daily catalogue of truce violations. Gerald Butt, BBC, Beirut.
Meanwhile, efforts to stabilize Beirut's fragile ceasefire hit a snag today. Two of the four members who sit on the newly established Security Committee boycotted today's session. The U.S. has developed a secret plan to equip a mobile strike force of Jordanian army units that would help fight disorders in the Persian Gulf, according to congressional sources. The administration has refused to confirm or deny the existence of the proposal, but unnamed officials quoted by UPI say $225 million has been hidden in this year's $251 billion defense budget to carry out the plan. Disclosure of the proposal comes against a backdrop of renewed concern that Iran may try to close the Straits of Hormuz, through which much of the West's oil must pass. South Korean President Chun Doo-hwan has appointed